You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan, Professor Juan Cole, proprietor of Informed Comment at juancole.com. Also on the program today, the Romney transition team gearing up. More concern over the potential of a grand bargain and cuts to Social Security. When I see stories suggesting that people are concerned about cuts to Social Security, I get worried about Medicare. That's the way that works, folks. Todd Akin, advice for you if you want a more responsive government, give them a good check. Talk more about the interesting study on the white working class. A roundup of the implications of the Verizon and Chicago teacher strike. Not the least of which is we may not ever have to worry about Rahm Emanuel as a national candidate. For you. Bullet dodged. A private city in Honduras for libertarians. And exhibit A as to why they came up with the term masshole. But first, ladies and gentlemen, before we get to Professor Cole, let me start with this. Bit of, I don't know, this is sort of happy news. Ladies and gentlemen, I know you think of Tony Baloney as, speaking of course of the cop who sprayed mace in the face of four or five young women's faces for no real reason. But maybe Tony Baloney isn't so much of an a-hole cop who just likes to get off on spraying mace. Maybe in some ways, what he was really spraying was Cupid's arrow. Because it turns out that, Kaylee Dedrick, the teacher's assistant from Albany, New York, who was... She was sort of out in front. I mean, she's the one who was really screaming in pain. And I don't mean to diminish that at all, of course. Apparently, one of the medics who, you know, one of the Occupy Wall Street medics who was there, because the cops, of course, were just sitting there watching. You know, half the cops were watching. The other half were going, looking at Tony Baloney like, why are you such an a-hole, dude? One of the medics came up and helped her, And apparently, love connection was made. And now Ms. Dedrick is expecting a child from that consummated with that medic. And do I don't know if we know his name. I think we do. But it was we hear this from her lawyer, Ron Kuby, my old buddy from Air America. So, Tony Baloney, A, just because you functioned as Cupid, don't assume, well, I guess it's no B, really, but just don't assume that now that you have not received any type of criminal liability, that Ron Kuby will not help in a civil action to sue the pants off of you. So that's an uplifting note.
And the NYPD ain't putting any of their funds towards defending Mr. Baloney.
Oh. Well, I hope a message is sent to other cops. Don't go and spray people in their face.
Because, especially when they're behind police lines.
Yes. Doing nothing to nobody. Folks, you know, this raises an important issue. If you are out there and do not and really want to meet somebody, you're a progressive, you want to meet somebody, but you don't want Tony Baloney to come and spray you in the face with mace, there's a better way. And that, of course, is strangeangels.com, sponsoring the show for this month. You head in there, you sign in, and instead of an algorithm or mace that puts you together with somebody, it's actually like a real person. And so even if you are not looking for to meet somebody, you can go to strangeangels.com and help out. Be one of those people who connects people. They're also having a lot of live functions. Go to strangeangels.com. As of now, I believe we are all done with the free memberships that Strange Angels, the trial memberships that they had offered. If you haven't heard from us, but you already sent in something as of the time you hear this, don't worry. We're just a little bit backlogged, but we will get to you. You'll get a full month. And so strangeangels.com. Check it out, folks. It's not only better than those other sites with their creepy, like, we don't like to... We don't believe in same-sex couples or whatever the creepiness and their creepy algorithms. It's also far more effective, at least probably statistically speaking, than mace spraying. So there you go. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Juan Cole.
It's a sunny day, but you still have made mistakes. The sunlight.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is my pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Juan Cole, professor at Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Michigan, author of many books, including Napoleon's Egypt. Is that what? Was that the last one, Professor?
I also have a more recent one, Engaging the Muslim
Indeed.
World.
All right, Engaging the Muslim World. I've read both, and please do not hesitate to check them out, folks. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Juan. I'm sorry. Okay, so, all right, well, so let's, I want to take us through the past 3 weeks or so, and I'm trying to organize this in my mind, if temporal or geographical is sort of the best way to go, and I think we'll probably do a little bit of both, but let's start with what we know about now what happened in Libya on September 11th, and to what extent that was a function of this supposed movie, which to me seems to me to be just the trailer seems to be all of it, as far as I can tell. But that set off protests in about a half dozen countries, I guess, maybe more, maybe 20 it was at that day. But let's focus on Libya. What do we know about whether or not the attack on the consulate was really a function of that film?
Well, you know, there's a fog of war. Things are very murky. It depends on who you talk to. The best account that I could piece together was done by a Libyan journalist, a young woman named Hadil al-Shalki, who writes for Reuters. And she alleged that there was a demonstration against the film outside the consulate, but that once things went violent and the consulate was set on fire, you know, there were 37 staff members who were evacuated by the Libyan police and commandos to a safe house outside Benghazi. And then once they were at the safe house, they came under mortar fire. So it sounds to me as though, and Hadil talked to people on the ground and was very thorough, that you know, there was a small crowd, a few hundred people that gathered for the protest, but that a terrorist cell, some people say it's Ansar al-Sharia, the supporters of Islamic law is what they call themselves, used that crowd as cover for an attack on the consulate of a much more deadly sort than the crowd had intended. I think probably the people in the crowd didn't intend to set the consulate on fire. But and there, you know, there are some reports that even the fire at the consulate was kind of accidental, that the police intervened in a heavy-handed way against the demonstrators, and that some of them were angry and had arms and fired back at the police and you know, hit the consulate instead. So it's a very murky situation, but that the consulate staff at their safe house came under mortar fire is a pretty strong indication that there was that the professional fighters, people who had maybe fought in Iraq or Afghanistan, must have taken advantage of the situation to get their fighting in.
Is it possible that there was forewarning that this was going to that they were going to move over there, or do you think this is something that they just simply got word?
Well, I don't know whether there was forewarning or not. What I can say, and without in any way meaning to place blame, especially on Ambassador Stevens, who's not here to defend himself, that consulate in Benghazi, Sam, was not a secure building. It was kind of ad hoc. I was in Libya in late May and early June, and I talked to a U.S. embassy person who was at the consulate at that time. And she's told me that it wasn't clear whether they would keep it as a consulate, whether Congress would authorize that. But it was just some compound that they had bought or rented, I don't know. You know, nowadays when the U.S. has an embassy someplace, they make it like a bunker. They put in all kinds of hard walls and security and so forth. And that house wasn't of that description.
And
so,
people should understand that the he chose to be in Benghazi to support the sort of, I guess, the I wouldn't the Free Libya or the sort of the new government. Is that right?
Well, that's why the compound had been taken over by the U.S. was because it was the headquarters of the Obama administration's liaison to the Free Libya fighters during the war against Gaddafi. But the thing that's puzzling to me is why Ambassador Stevens and his staff would spend the anniversary of September 11th in an unsecured building in Benghazi. That is to say, if somebody had come to me and asked me, not that I'm anybody, but if someone had asked me, where should the ambassador to Libya be on September 11th, I would have said, you know, in the embassy in Tripoli.
Right.
So there's and nobody at the State Department seems to know why he was there. And obviously he thought it was important that he be there. He had a lot of contacts in Benghazi and was lionized there. So he was doing some good work. But it seems to me that there was a cell, a terrorist cell operating in Benghazi. We know that because it had attacked the Red Cross offices. It attacked a convoy of the British consulate in the months before this happened, and that they took advantage of the demonstration about the film. They used those people as cover to launch a much more professional kind of attack on the U.S. Consular personnel.
And now, in the past couple of days, or in the days following, we have seen reports of essentially of the Libyans in Benghazi driving out who they suspected to have committed the attack.
Oh, absolutely! The people in Benghazi, you know, it's a fairly large city. And most Libyans actually just live in Tripoli, Benghazi, and Misrata, the three largest cities. So, you know, you're talking about a million people. They were just furious as to what had been done to Ambassador Stevens, whom they lionized, and to the reputation of their city, more importantly. And there's a local element in all that, in the sense that you know, the Libyan government collapsed when Gaddafi fell. He was the government. You didn't have, you know, a really professional police force of any size. The army is still in tatters. And it's natural, you know, after a revolution like that against an authoritarian state, that the state institutions are weak. And neighborhood militias had taken up that slack, would do patrols and so forth. But, you know, you got these young guys with guns, and they start showing off, and they start lording it over other people. And it's not just neighborhood protection anymore, you know, but they become a little bit like gangs. And people were sick and tired of this stuff. So they attacked three militia headquarters. One of them was suspected of involvement in the consular attacks. So the other two were just like disliked as local militias, mm-hmm. that people wanted an end to them.
And so this seems to me to be an encouraging sign where you have that many people who are that motivated to create a, you know, some sense of civil society that is at the very least, you know, sort of providing some type of check on these militias, you know, regardless of what their orientation is, but just in terms of the way that they are decreasing stability, I guess.
That's right. Well, the vast majority of Libyans really wants to move forward. And they had a transitional government, which means it wasn't elected, it wasn't appointed, it was just like self-appointed, and nobody had put it there. And I think those people, first of all, a lot of them weren't on the ball, and second of all, they had no real legitimacy or source of authority. Now you've got an elected parliament, an elected prime minister, and I think Mr. Magariv, Mustafa Abu Shukur, the new prime minister, they have a mandate the president and the prime minister to go forward with building the new state. And the people very much want this. They're tired of lawlessness, and the Libyan government has moved way too slowly to rebuild the police and the army. Admittedly, that takes a long time. And when I was in Tripoli in early June, I saw a bunch of young guys who had just graduated from the police academy, and they were kind of hot-rodding it through Tripoli and honking horns and celebrating. And they just needed a lot more of that.
And so let's move to Egypt. What has been the fallout of the protests there? How has the backlash? I know that it seems that there to the extent that there was a rift between, or President Obama expressed to President Morsi dissatisfaction and sort of a reclassification of our relationship with Egypt based upon their response, things seem to have normalized. But just give me the sense of what developed out of that and what that showed us about the Egyptian government.
Well, the first thing to say is that there wasn't really an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, in the sense that people came into the embassy. That embassy really is hardened, and it wouldn't be easy to get near the main offices. But there were a couple thousand, a mixture of people, hardline Muslims who are called Salafis, and really fundamentalists, and then. You know, there are a lot of soccer hoodlums in Egypt who were radicalized because the police used to bother them and crack down on them, and who have thrown in with the Muslim militants. They're not themselves militant Muslims. They're soccer hoodlums, but they're glad to join in making trouble. So it was apparently a mixture of those kinds of people that demonstrated outside the U.S. Embassy, that tore down the flag and so forth. It's a small group of people. 2,000. But Cairo has a metropolitan population of 20 million. And if people call for a demonstration and several tens of thousands don't show up, they consider it a dismal failure. So this was a small thing in Cairo. It obviously made for a lot of press headlines and so forth, but it doesn't, it's not a bellwether of what Egyptians think about the United States. But it did provoke a crisis because the president himself is a fundamentalist Muslim, not as hardline as the people who demonstrated outside the embassy. And he, has a problem that he has to please his base, who approved of that demonstration, at the same time that he has to navigate a new relationship with the Obama administration, with the United States. So he dragged his feet on condemning the attack on the embassy got pressure, apparently, from his own party, from the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, to say something, because a lot of those guys are businessmen and are hoping for American investments in Egypt. And were dismayed that President Morsi was not more forthcoming. So he finally came out a couple of days later and denounced it, but clearly annoyed Barack Obama so much that Obama demoted Egypt from the ranks of major non-NATO ally to something more neutral. And in an interview this week, as he's in New York for the UN, Morsi repaid the compliment. He declined to say that the U.S. was his ally, and just said he was hoping that it would be a friend.
Interesting. And so, but we're getting a sense. I guess this is sort of the. I don't know. On some level, there's a certain, education as to where the boundaries are and where Morsi can go domestically and where he can't afford to go domestically.
Right. Well, Morsi has to give signals for his base that, Egypt has had a revolution, the pro-American puppet dictator Mubarak has been overthrown. So he can't afford to be seen inside Egypt as just another pro-American puppet. He has to give signals of Egypt's independence. On the other hand, the United States does give Egypt $1.5 billion a year in aid, and it promotes Egypt, you know, as a place to invest. The United States has very extensive relations with Egypt. USAID, at one point at least, had 17,000 subcontractors working on various projects there. So, you know, Egypt needs the United States economically and diplomatically. And so Morsi has to try to, you know, signal that he's independent at the same time that he doesn't go so far as to alienate the United States altogether. And that's the situation we're in now, and why there are all these mixed signals and uncertainties.
Now the tremendous amount of aid that we give Egypt, does not most of that go to the military? Now, I also know that the military in Egypt is far more integrated with the economy than I think we would sort of perceive based upon what our military does. And how does that dynamic work between Morsi and the military? If I've characterized the role that aid plays properly.
Well, the USAID is in two parts. It's about 50-50, military and civilian. The civilian part of it is, you know, it's significant and it's cream. It's something extra in the economy. Although it's structured in a way, you know, Sam, it's a little bit of a shell game because the American Congress sets up this foreign aid business so that the aid mostly goes to American corporations who then provide in-kind goods to Egypt. So sure, you know, the military gets about half of it, and in the form of machinery. And I don't know, some of the machinery they get is earth movers, and then they're using that to build factories and things. The military itself is a kind of corporation in Egypt. There are estimates that it has as much as 5-10% of the economy. There are higher estimates, but I don't think that they're believable. But Morsi has a difficult relationship with the military, which had been, you know, Mubarak and that regime had come out of the military, and now a civilian fundamentalist is the president. A lot of people in the military are very nervous about that. But Morsi very cleverly seems to have made alliances with some of the more fundamentalist officers and some of the ambitious younger officers, and so he's moved out some of the old guard and promoted people more friendly to himself. So the tensions with the military have subsided a little bit since he rearranged it a little somewhat, and that is a sign of his deftness. But the big issue that's lying before the United States and Egypt is Palestine. Morsi believes that the Camp David peace accords with Israel include, and I think Jimmy Carter agrees with this, an aspiration for Palestinian statehood and an end to the Israeli occupation of the of Gaza and the West Bank. And he believes that, you know, the peace between Israel and Egypt is a good thing, it should hold, but the Camp David accords have not been completely implemented as long as the Palestinians don't have citizenship in any state. And so he's apparently going to press this issue, and it's one of the tensions between him and the Obama administration that he's going to be much more independent on the issue than the Mubarak government was.
That's interesting. And how do you, I mean, assuming for the moment that President Obama is president, wins re-election, I don't want you to go out on a limb here. Hypothetically speaking, do you think that would be to the advantage of President Obama's in terms of being able to position? I mean, if he is inclined, and there's a lot of people who, you know, always look to the second term of a presidency as one where, particularly one where they don't have control of Congress or at least the same party, where, you know, foreign policy tends to be where people want to make their mark. If he is interested in sort of engaging in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and assuming that perhaps Netanyahu is not there much longer, because I think at least my sense is he is the biggest roadblock, at least you know, from the Israeli side. I mean, in terms of personalities, would it not be to President Obama's advantage, if he's attempting to be an honest broker, to have an Egypt that is sort of pressing the point?
Well, I have to say that that's a very perceptive question, Sam, and I concur with the thrust of it. I think if the Netanyahu government fell, or there were new elections and he wasn't prime minister, which, as you say, is possible because his favorability ratings are really low, and his coalition is shaky. So were Netanyahu not there, if you had someone like Tzipi Livni or one of the opposition party members who was more interested in withdrawing from the West Bank than Netanyahu is, then part of what you would need going forward would be more unity and more willingness to negotiate on the Palestinian side, especially with regard to Hamas and Gaza, which often takes pretty hardline stances and isn't even on the same page with the other Palestinians. And there, I think Morsi could be a really important partner, in the sense that he has excellent relations with Hamas, and I think would be in a position to get them to the negotiating table, join in with the PLO, which is much more willing to negotiate. You could imagine the stars aligning so that Obama had some kind of success in moving the Israel-Palestine issue, positively forward, and not just, as Romney said, kicking the can down the road.
Right, and then moving north for a moment into Syria. What is the? I mean, because I see obviously what happened in Libya was tragic and a horrible situation, but to the extent that horrible situations happened, it seems that what has happened in Libya since then is encouraging, but encouraging for the Libyans themselves, and encouraging, in a broader sense. And also, I think the same thing of Egypt, that President Morsi was able to sort of recalibrate and understand, sort of maintain what was necessary to sort of develop some stability there. I mean, everybody seems to be sort of working in some fashion with each other to sort of come to some sense of stability. In Syria, what is happening in Syria at this point? And is there any chance that there's going to be any movement, or is it just something that's going to have to, is this just going to be an ongoing situation in Syria?
Well, it's likely to grind on for some time. I perceive over the last 18 months, the government has lost more and more credibility, and actually is now losing control over swathes of the country, to the point where the rebel leaders, some of them defectors from the officer corps, have now announced that they're going to set up inside Syria rather than over the border in Turkey. This is a sign of confidence on their part. But it's horrible. You know, you turn on the Arab satellite television stations, and there are women screaming and bombs falling, and it's a carnage. The human toll is enormous now. It's over 20,000 dead, and no end in sight. Today, the regime scrambled fighter jets and bombed a town called Rika, near the Turkish border, which is very dangerous. There's always danger that war could break out between Syria and Turkey over all this. But the regime is very well armed going into it. It had 5,000 tanks. It has fighter jets. It has helicopter gunships. The rebels only have light arms. They have machine guns and some rocket-propelled grenades. apparently the Americans are not supplying them with arms and not supplying them with money for military purposes. And their main purpose, the Americans inside Turkey, the CIA is running units that are filtering the arms so as to make sure that the rebels don't get heavy arms from Qatar and Saudi Arabia and from the international arms market. So in a way, the U.S. Is inadvertently guaranteeing that this will go on for a long time, because as long as the rebels don't have the ability to shoot down the helicopter gunships or to take out the tanks in large numbers, they occasionally do kill tanks, it guarantees that this will be a slow, grinding guerrilla war. I don't anticipate it being over soon.
Well, what is the, I mean, surely the CIA and the American government can make that same calculation that you're making. I mean, that it's, but it's, perhaps it's not necessarily inadvertent. What is the theory behind this?
They're afraid. I mean, there are basically Al-Qaeda elements fighting in Syria. They're small, but they're afraid that a small group with heavy arms could take over the country. So they were mauled in Iraq, where, you know, essentially the United States was chased out of Iraq in part by a Sunni radical insurgency. And they don't want to see those people become powerful in Syria. And neither, of course, do our allies in the region. Nobody among our allies, nobody among the neighbors of Syria would like to see Al-Qaeda types come to power in Damascus. So the U.S. is concerned that the groups that it approves of, the more moderate groups, get the weaponry in hopes that they can ride that weaponry ultimately to power. So that's their calculation. The problem with the theory is that it doesn't account for the ways in which, if the war goes on and on and on, the Syrian population itself can become radicalized, and then it's not a matter of, you know, some guys who came over from Baghdad or some hardline Salafis from some particular town, but you could have a large number of Syrians become radicalized and more angry, and when the whole thing is over, you could get a very unpleasant government in Damascus. And, you know, the analogy for this thing is Algeria, where there was a civil war in the 90s that we didn't pay any attention to, but where things became very polarized between secularists and hardline Muslims.
And is there a sense in Syria that the Americans are not, specifically that the Americans or the West are not doing anything, or is there an awareness that the Soviet Union is perhaps because their relationship with Syria?
Sam, the Russian Federation.
Sorry about that. the Russians, yes. I'm still talking about Czechoslovakia. I'm still catching up on things.
Yeah. We're men of the 20th century.
Indeed. The Russians, you know, because the relationship between the Russians and the Assad government, I mean, is there a sense that are the Syrian people looking to the West to do something here? Do they realize that's not going to happen, or what is the sense there?
Well, the Syrian people, I've talked to Syrian expatriates both here and when I was in Turkey this summer. They're aware that the cavalry is not likely to arrive from the West, and they're pretty sore about it. They're furious at Iran and Russia for supporting the Assad regime to the hilt, and they have actually had demonstrations in which they burned the Iranian flag. So welcome to the club. But they had hoped that the West would help in some way, and it hasn't happened. It's in part because Europe in particular, is afraid of doing things that might get you tried in The Hague. And without a United Nations Security Council resolution authorizing the use of force, it's dangerous to use force. You really could. Any official who ordered it could end up being on trial. So that's what the French diplomats have told me. They'd like to, you know, do some kind of intervention, but they can't. They just feel that they can't do it without the backing of international law. So the veto of Russia and China at the UN is a big factor in keeping the international community from acting in Syria. So, you know, there are reports that reporters have talked to fighters in Aleppo who, you know, are really, really angry at the West for hanging them out to dry. And that's why I say the longer this goes on, the more dangers of subsequent radicalism there are.
Interesting. And lastly, and I appreciate your hanging with me today. There's a new report that has come out in the last day or so from Stanford and New York University researchers, specifically on the drone program that we have been, instituting in Pakistan since 2004, is my understanding. And apparently there are two aspects of it that rather disturbing. One is the nature of this double tap, I guess they call it, drone attacks, where they U.S. drones will attack they will perform a strike and then they'll come back just moments later and strike again, basically scaring off people from providing medical assistance. This report supposedly says that just 1 in 50 victims of these strikes in Pakistan are known militants, and you know we've talked in the past on this program about the sort of the loose definition of militants in the case of these attacks, which basically ultimately amount to anybody who gets hit is almost by definition a militant in the eyes of the United States. To what extent is this destabilizing in Pakistan? And, you know, also in the context of the recent, protests about, again, this film?
Well, the U.S. drone strikes in the tribal belt of Pakistan are the problem with them is that there's no framework of legality for them. And they're classified, so you and I can't even be sure they're happening according to the U.S. government. The U.S. government won't talk to us about it if we ask them. And then this study, which follows on investigative work that was done by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the U.K., which is young journalists. It's a foundation doing nonprofit work. They have been looking at casualties and at this double strike tactic. But one of the things that happens if you send another drone in just after the first one is that you kill the medics, you kill the people who came to help. By the way, something that the Viet Cong used to do to the United States in the Vietnam War. And it's a war crime, you know, if they're deliberately striking twice that way and killing what are essentially helpers and aid workers the second time, then it's a war crime. And so it's, let us say in the language of diplomacy, extremely unhelpful.
Right.
But, you know, the politics of it inside Pakistan are weird because the government of Asif Ali Zardari apparently likes it just fine behind the scenes. That's what came out in the WikiLeaks. Is that those militants are scary to them too, and they're happy enough to have the U.S. drone them to death. And then opinion polling in the tribal belt itself shows that local people mostly like it because the militants have made their lives hell and often tried to dominate them or have brought trouble to them. So it's as you get away from the tribal belt in the cities of Lahore or Karachi in Pakistan, people really dislike it because they see it as a derogation from Pakistan's sovereignty, and they are anyway primed to be anti-imperialist since Pakistan was under British rule and became independent of the West. They don't like to see Western intervention again. So, you know, I think the majority of Punjabis, the largest ethnic group in Pakistan, don't like it. The government is all right with it, and the people in the tribal belt who aren't militants seem to like it. So it's a very mixed picture. But on the whole and by and large, I think what we should be concerned about is that we shouldn't be committing war crimes.
Right.
And when the U.S. is killing people, there should be like a declaration of war or some legal framework, you know, so that the people in the Republic of the United States can talk about it, so that it's not completely classified. I mean, this is very troubling to have our government essentially assassinating people and then having the public in the United States, which is supposedly a democracy, not even be able to talk about it with any specificity because it's classified.
Right. I mean, obviously, as perpetrators of this, there's a broader constituency that our government has to answer to, its own people, and also internationally, we're sending out some pretty bad signals. I mean, I can understand it from the Pakistani government perspective that they can outsource their sort of their dirty work, I guess. And though, as you're breaking down the different dynamics of which constituencies within Pakistan have do or do not have a problem with this, could not the government in Pakistan give this a patina that would in some way mitigate the issues of sovereignty, but at the same time also, I mean, are they sort of posturing that they're in no way involved in this because they're afraid of blowback from those areas, even though the civilian population there seems to support it?
Yes, it's a little bit darkly humorous, but the Pakistani prime minister comes out regularly and denounces the drone attacks. Says that we will not stand for this, and the United States has to answer for it. Stop doing that. And then we know from the WikiLeaks that behind the scenes they authorized it.
Interesting. Well, Professor Cole, thank you so much for getting us updated on all of these the situations in that area of the world. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
Likewise, Sam. Best wishes.
Okay, thank you, Juan. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. Well, it seems to be that time. Professor Juan Cole. Just a little house cleaning. Let you know, tomorrow on this program, we will be running two interviews, both of which were pre-recorded. One from a Majority Report listener who I thought would be interesting to hear from because he essentially, and we've had this conversation in the past in the context of third parties, he essentially is, he was a progressive and wanted to influence the Democratic Party in his native territory of the Northwest of this country, and just took it upon himself to get involved, and now has a pretty decent amount of power in the context of politics in his congressional district. And I wanted to just walk through it with him so that people could hear. Hopefully you can find it inspiring to get involved, and you can make your own determination as to whether or not his route is provides more efficacy than actually recreating an entirely different third political party. Because to me, political parties are simply apparatus, and they are made up of people. It would be nice to think that political parties in and of themselves represent some sort of ideology or morality or ethics. But at the end of the day, they're simply an apparatus. And the individuals who control that apparatus determine what the ideology and ethics and values of that party ultimately be. And I'm not even convinced that most of those people even operate with that agenda. I think that most of those people in the apparatus use it to, for the most part, to further some of their own personal agendas, and which may or may not, at a different time, sort of dovetail with the politics of the people that they represent. But I think Richard addresses some of that in our talk tomorrow. And also we'll play an interview I did for Ring of Fire last weekend from J.A. Meyerson talking about the Occupy movement in fairly broad terms. And then on top of that, for members, keep this under your hat, folks, there'll be some audio of some recent TV work that I did that you may not be able to carry around on your iPhone, but you wanted to, or your Zune, or your BlackBerry, or your Palm Pilot, or your brother word processor, whatever it is that people put it on, their Ataris. But you could also listen to it on your Roku.
Your mini-disc player.
Yes, if you want to burn this baby to mini-disc or to laser-disc, you can do that as well. It's harder to travel with laser-discs.
Or maybe even play it and record it on a cassette.
You could do it on a cassette. Or some of you still may have that recordable 8-track device. Do it. So that will be there. And folks, reminder, yesterday was a sad day here for us at the Majority Report because we had no new members. And we cried. Really cried. Hard. And then the tears that dropped from my face shorted out one of the hard drives in our computers. So
it's the second one in a week.
We have ordered a fan. Folks, if you... we should really be videotaping this because I think if you people understood that not only am I reading up on all the stuff we talk about, not only am I, you know, working, particularly Hillary is like almost sliced her hand off with a can opener. And we should really post that safe can opener thing that I have, put a link to Amazon. But not only are we having to do like all sort of like, you know, filing data entry on over emails and whatnot. One moment I am trying to establish the HTML code for the colors on our website to put into our newsletter. And the next moment I am opening up not just unibody ones, but pre-2007 MacBook Pros to reinstall hard drives or put in new hard drives, which Matt mistakenly thought was, dude, we all
Lies.
Know what you said. I asked, was the
Lies.
Sound coming from the corner? And you said, yes, turned out to be a fan. So now I've ordered a fan. I'm going to replace the fan. I'm going to take the hard drive out of the Sinclair. I'm going to move that into the Burton because the Burton one is clicking now. And this is not the fan. This is the Burton's hard drive clicking. And that baby, when that baby blows up, that's going to be a problem. So the long and short of it, folks, is become a member. Because every time I see that a new member has popped up, it brings a smile to my face. And I'm sure those of you who have kids know it's not all smiles, not all peaches and cream. Right? I'm thinking of this morning when my daughter threw a fit because I told her, got to wear leggings with that skirt because the skirt is too short. She's 7. Didn't work out that well. All right, folks. There's other ways to support this program, of course. If you go to majority.fm, click on support the show. You can give us a review on iTunes. That is always helpful. You can buy justcoffee.coop. Fair Trade Coffee, a great outfit in Wisconsin. In Madison, they provided free coffee to the protesters. Employee-owned, fair trade, so you're not drinking coffee from exploited people. You know, we're going to talk about these Foxconn riots. There's very few products that you can engage in, that you can use, where you don't have to stop thinking about how it ended up there. You know, using your iPhone or your Dell computer, if you take the time to think about who had to put that together, it becomes rather difficult to live your life. The clothes you buy, 98% of our clothing business left this country. So to buy kids' clothes, every time I look at it, you know, look at it. Bangladesh now is, I guess, the big one, or Indonesia. Used to be China, but they just keep finding the lower cost labor, kids' labor probably. And so
soon there'll be a city in Honduras for them to all move to.
We'll talk about that, but I'm serious about this. And so to be able to get your coffee, it's one thing, but know that you're getting it from a company that pays everybody along the line a fair wage, including the employees, that, I don't know, that makes me feel good, and I'm happy they're a sponsor. So you also get 10% discount coupon code with Majority. Use the coupon code Majority. And there's also a Majority Report blend. So, and of course, on the flip side of that, Amazon's not the worst company in the world. But if you buy your crap through Amazon, you can make yourself feel a little better by buying it through our Amazon link at majority.fm. Support the show. Click on the link, bookmark it. Use it always to buy your Amazon stuff. We get a little bit of a kickback. You can join us in the better half of the program, 646-257-3920. I am me at Majority FM. See you on the flip side.